I made a change. Now, before we get started, how many people weren't here yesterday? We've got a couple new faces. Have you guys taken a geology class before? Yeah, we got some geology. Good. Well, no. All right. Well, then a lot of what we're going to talk, if you had geology, a lot of what we're going to talk about is going to be somewhat familiar, right? And we're going to try to keep things at a very conversational place. This is not, I'm a firm believer that this thing is going to get me. I'm going to take this, wrap it up. At the university level, I don't believe that I teach, right? What I believe that I do is I help people decide to learn, right? And so as we go through the material we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about earth materials, we're going to kind of finish up some of the things that we didn't do yesterday. We're going to talk about all the rocks that you see around us, right? It's very important that I encourage blurting, right? If you got a question, just say, "Hey, Dax," right? You can raise your hand, you can wave, you can stand, or you can just talk, right? There are going to be lots of opportunities to chatter. I want to chatter, right? Because we're all here together, and hopefully we all have opportunities to learn a few things, right? All right, so today's lesson is earth materials. For those that weren't here yesterday, I wanted to acknowledge that even in New York City, I do my science on native lands, right? At Queens College, we are on the indigenous lands of the Musi Lapi, the Lakwa, the Manicock, and we are very grateful for their stewardship of the land that we currently occupy. And just like Holden Village, I do my work on lands carved by glaciers, right? And when I was putting this together, oh, that's me, that's a really big version of me. I'm an assistant professor. Most of you already know almost all of this, but basically I've got lots of projects doing lots of things, and then I would say that if I were to summarize my approach to science, it's to try to do third grade experiments, right? I think of things that are cool and fun, and then I try to get those things done, right? Our learning objectives today are to finish our conversation about the structure of Washington. And in order to do that, we're going to talk about accreted terrains, right? We left our conversation. The last thing that we discussed was subduction zones. And in a very odd way, where we are currently sitting has been affected by the presence of subduction zones in multiple ways. So we're going to talk about that. Then we're going to talk about materials, right? We're going to talk about how minerals are formed, how their ions, I'm going to use a really fancy word, it's ion. We're going to talk about what that means, right? How those ions interact with one another at various forms of rock evolution. And then we're going to talk about how we discuss rocks, right? Now, this was your homework in our last class. And how many people did it? Oh, all I can say is that this is okay, because we have an opportunity to do it now. If you don't have a rock with you, please make sure that you come grab one. We've got some rocks right here. On the back sheet of your handout, there is a blank sheet of paper. And what I want you to do, and I'm going to turn on the lights, is I want you to look at your rock and write down what you see. Right? And when I say look at your rock, I want you to use your words. I don't want you to think to yourself about how a geologist might look at your rock. Right? If you think it looks shiny, tell me it looks shiny. If you think that it looks homogeneous, tell me it looks homogeneous. Right? Pointy, sharp, speckled, gray, layered. All right, so as you've collected your thoughts, please share them with somebody sitting near you. Look at your rocks together. And I really want, as you do this comparison, to ask them how they would have said it. How they would have said it. They don't have to record it. But I think that you're going to find that two different sets of eyes looking at the same rock will notice different things. Or will, in some cases, notice the same things but explain it differently. All right. How many people had words like sparkly in their descriptions? Sparkles. Princess Sparkles. What about spotted? Anybody have spots? Ooh. What about light and dark colors? I've got a question. Did anybody have something that appeared to have a random distribution or a random pattern to it? What about something that was distinctly not random? Something that had order to it, that was layered perhaps? Layered? All right. Okay, now, let's all keep our rocks. Oh. And then how many people encountered different language from the person they compared it with? Right? Different words? Find your words? Okay, so here's what we're going to do. As we go through today, I want you to keep your rock, okay? And as we're discussing rocks, as you see things that might relate to your rock, I want you to write down the big words that are associated with it, okay? Now, it's important to understand that we don't really care whether we learn the big words, but we would like to get to where you would describe your rock the same way that she might describe your rock, right? So as we're working through today's lesson, keep updating your description. Does that sound fair? Does everybody understand what we're going to do? Okay, cool. All right, so here's where we left off. We left off talking about subduction zones, and it occurs to me that one of the coolest things about subduction zones is what? Anybody have an opinion here? I think the coolest thing is the earthquakes. Hi. All right, so this is the Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964. This happened in 1964, and it was an important earthquake because it helped us understand, for among the very first times, that the process of subduction was related to plate tectonics. So let's watch this and kind of get a sense for what this was like.
The 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake occurred on Good Friday and rocked the state with strong ground shaking that lasted 4.5 minutes. At magnitude 9.2, it was the second largest quake ever recorded by seismologists. Its memory haunts those who lived through the shaking and experienced the tsunami that destroyed entire communities. This earthquake also rocked the scientific community by confirming a major principle of plate tectonics, with the observation that the oceanic Pacific plate dives beneath the continental North American plate at the Aleutian Trench. Alaska has over 24,000 measured earthquakes every year, more than the rest of the U.S. combined.
Not true anymore.
Shown here are only those above magnitude 6. On average, at least one strong magnitude 7 earthquake occurs every year. Between 1899 and 1986, 8 earthquakes of magnitude 8 or greater impacted different areas of the Aleutian subduction zone. Red circles mark the epicenter above the site where the fault rupture began, whereas yellow shows the fault rupture area. How can we understand the relative energy released by a great earthquake of magnitude 9 compared to smaller yet still damaging earthquakes? And just what is the rupture zone? The energy released by earthquakes increases by a factor of 30 for each unit increase in magnitude. As an analogy, if breaking a single strand of pasta represents a magnitude 5 earthquake, then we need to break 30 strands to represent a 6, 900 strands for a 7, and 27,000 noodles to represent a magnitude 8. To represent the energy released in a magnitude 9 earthquake, like the recent earthquake in Japan, we would need to break an immense bundle of 810,000 noodles. And the Alaska 1964 earthquake was even larger at magnitude 9.2. To address the great earthquake rupture process, let's first examine the plate tectonics of the North Pacific region. The distribution of earthquake epicenters, shown earlier, roughly defines plate boundaries. The Aleutian Trench marks a 2,100-mile-long subduction boundary between the Pacific and North American plates, similar to the Nazca Plate diving beneath the South American Plate at the Peru-Chile Trench. Along southeast Alaska and western British Columbia, the Pacific Plate grinds against the North American Plate in a strike slip motion, as it does along the San Andreas Fault in California. The rate of subduction varies from 2.2 to 3 inches per year. We will animate the 1964 earthquake in four consecutive perspectives to understand what happened. Most people think of an earthquake as a sudden release of energy at the epicenter. In reality, an earthquake is caused by sudden displacement of rock across a fault at a given depth within the Earth at the hypocenter. For great earthquakes, the displacement at the hypocenter is just the beginning. The initial fault break in 1964 triggered a runaway rupture that displaced an area more than 500 miles long. The entire fault rupture elapsed over 4.5 minutes, releasing immense seismic energy equivalent to a cascade of 1,000 magnitude 7 earthquakes. Let's zoom in now to a cross-section to view the plate interaction. The dense oceanic plate dives beneath the more buoyant continental plate at a rate of about 2.5 inches per year. Because tectonic plates are elastic like a spring, converging plates build energy at the leading edge of the continent. Locked by friction, the upper plate is forced back and shortened, raising the land surface. GPS, not available in 1964, is now available to measure that strain. In 1964, the force of the converging plates overcame friction and caused the leading edge to lurch seaward, uplifting the seafloor, forming a mound of seawater that spread out as a tsunami. As coastal areas near the trench were uplifted, areas inland dropped. During the 1964 earthquake, the broad area at the leading edge of the overlying plate rose up as high as 9 meters, as the landward region subsided up to 2 meters, thus raising the shoreline barnacles well above sea level and dropping the inland shoreline below sea level, killing trees, leaving its legacy in ghost forests. The ground shook relentlessly as the rupture progressed along the fault surface. Prolonged shaking served to liquefy underground water-saturated sediment. Liquefaction triggered the landslides that caused major damage in Anchorage. Deformation of the seafloor, especially uplift along the Patton Bay Fault, produced a tsunami that spread across the Pacific Ocean. Astonishingly, only 9 people died from the earthquake itself, but 130 were killed by the subsequent tsunami that wreaked havoc across the northern Pacific region. In the early 1960s, plate tectonic theory was in its infancy, and subduction was poorly understood. Soon after the earthquake, measurements of land and seafloor deformation taken by United States Geological Survey geologist George Plafker and co-workers led them to propose that underthrusting of the Pacific plate beneath Alaska caused the earthquake. This discovery helped establish subduction of oceanic plates beneath continental plates and megathrust earthquakes as fundamental processes of plate tectonics. Since 1964, when there were only 2 seismometers in Alaska, monitoring earthquakes and ground deformation to assess hazards and to mitigate future risk has greatly increased. Research that characterizes earthquakes and fault lines serves to reduce the possibility of casualties by better land use planning and constructing earthquake-resistant buildings, allowing us to live more safely in earthquake zones.
All right. So when we think about the next big earthquake, let's look at this subduction zone. Now, this is a drawing that that my students learned to make. It's sorry. I'm going to apologize. I do stutter on occasion. Which, by the way, I didn't know until I figured out that my daughter stuttered. And then my wife informed me that this is something that I do too. So this is an image. So this is a drawing that the typical students will learn how to make, right? And we're not gonna, there's no tests here, so we're gonna just look at it, and I wanna think about each of these key parts that I've highlighted on the key, because they tell you something about the process that's associated with the mid-ocean ridge spreading and the subduction of the plate, right? And let's start right here. So this is our mid-ocean ridge. This is where we have new crust forming off the coast. This is actually the Juan de Fuca plate. This is actually the North American plate, right? And we have a fairly young lithospheric plate being subducted under North America, right? And that M signifies decompression melting, right? And we're going to talk a lot today about melting stuff. And I want you to think about what melting stuff really is, right? What is heat? Heat is kinetic energy, right? So just briefly, does anybody have something they'd offer about how, what is the process of melting? What does that, what's actually happening there? Change state. It's changed state, but why does it change state?
You're breaking ionic bonds. Some kind of
bond. Oh, and he brought in the magic word ion, right? We're putting energy, yes?
Molecules are being energized. They're moving more.
They're processing.
Less interested in each other, and start
moving
about and mingling with new ones.
Oh, we've started to anthropomorphize. And we're going to keep with that, because we're going to talk about things that make molecules happy, things that make molecules sad, and what things in nature want to do, right? But what's happening right there, where that M is a function of two things, right? It's a function of heat, but it's also a function of pressure, because right here at this ridge, we have less lithospheric pressure on what's beneath it, right? And just like kinetic energy is what it takes to break ionic bonds, pressure is that other force that affects when things melt. The more we squeeze something, the more resilient to melting it is. Think of pressure, in this case, as kind of a girdle of sorts that will hold things together and make them harder to melt. So if we start to move a rock up to where it's subjected to less pressure, it can have the exact same temperature and start to melt, right? So what's happening here is we're migrating rock up, and as the pressure releases, we start to get just a little bit of melt. And when you think about the volume of the asthenosphere, the volume of the mantle, just a little bit of melt is enough to create a lot of magma, right? Now, this L and that L, that represents lithosphere, right? And you can see here that at the mid-ocean ridge, our lithosphere is basically non-existent. It's very, very, very thin. The mantle is communicating almost to the surface. But as we move away, that lithosphere thickens in both directions, right? Here's our subduction zone. What's this right here? What's happening at this edge? Yeah, it's fish goo, right? This seafloor is bare at the ridge. But as the years go by, as the eons go by, it collects sediment day in and day out. And by the time it gets here, there's a huge lid of sediment that is being scraped off and is creating this wedge, right? Okay. That's also a trench that you can't see. All right, what else? F. What do you think the F stands for? This is really a fancy term. It's called flux melting, right? So we know that the chemistry of something impacts when it will melt, correct? That's the other thing. We've got chemistry, we've got pressure, and we've got temperature. Well, this lithosphere that's being subducted, or this crust that's being subducted, is full of water. And that water has started to have chemical reactions with the basalt that it's interacting with, right? Those chemical reactions change the melting temperature of the basalt. As we subduct, we get hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and then this starts to melt at a much lower temperature than what we would expect otherwise. Right? But that temperature, even though it's lower than what basalt normally melts at, is still quite a bit higher than the melting temperature of continental crust. So as we melt this stuff, this very, very hot magma migrates up and interacts with a much more volatile and explosive material above it, and it melts it. Now I want you to think about this as your hot fudge and your ice cream sundae, right? Because by the time it gets up here, they are now one, right? They're one thing. Does that make sense? All right. Let's see. Is there anything else on here? Oh, and then those X's.
I have a question.
Absolutely. Yes, so this is, well, and once again, that density is going to continue to increase as we get deeper and deeper, but this is a good bulk density for mantle materials, right? And this is actually a big part of the story that we're not going to go too deeply into today, but these buoyancy relationships are essentially how the Earth works, right? The buoyancy drives how the ocean operates. It's how our atmosphere operates, and it's certainly how geologic structures operate as well. All right, so we've got our subduction zone. We've got our accretionary wedge. What's that? This is an island arc of some sort, right? This is something that has been the result of other volcanism that is converging with the continent, right? The accretionary wedge, what happens when it hits the continent? Kind of stacks up, right? What do you think happens when that thing hits it? Because on both sides of the North American continent, the mountain ranges that we see are directly the result of this type of a collision, right? When you go to the Adirondacks, what you're looking at is the result of an island arc that has crashed into North America, right? And most of Washington's terrain is the result of a successive system of island arcs that are converging. We've got North America. What direction is North America going? Do we remember? Yeah, we're going that way, right? And we've got these island arcs coming this way. Boom. The continent just got bigger, right? And it didn't just happen once. Here it is again, right? It's happening on the East Coast, and it's happening on the West Coast, right? We're essentially glomming on large hunks of volcanic material that was created offshore, right? And I think what is most interesting about this is those sawtooths. You remember yesterday when we talked about what these were on that very first map that we looked at? Can anybody see what this means? Compare that. So here's a subduction zone that eventually drives our current tectonic structure. This is the Farallon Plate. It's subducting underneath north what is now the North America, the accreted North America. What do you guys see here?
Going the other way.
Yeah. Our subduction zones go underneath the continent in this direction. These subduction zones were going the other way. So essentially, the collision of North America was happening as subducting plates were going underneath these accreted terrains in the other direction. Now, that's cool. And it's cool because it means that our current structure has these accreted terrains, all this stuff being subducted under by the current Juan de Fuca plate. And so we've got a subduction zone that is creating the flux melting underneath these old island arcs. And it looks something like that. So this is a cross-sectional view of the state of Washington. And there's some fiction here, right? Because it shows kind of what we should expect. Here's our subduction zone. What is this?
Accretionary wedge.
Yeah, and we've jammed it right up out of the water, right? We've got this. We've got the basin, which is the Puget Sound, and we've got this big area of essentially lowlands, which is Western Washington, right? Here, the subduction zone is creating this flux melting, and you can see that the results are this entire central portion of our state, where we've got Mount Baker, right? Where we've got Glacier Peak, where we've got Mount Rainier, where we've got Mount Adams, Mount Hood, right? Right here in the center. And then if we go a little bit further, this is where we get a little bit fictional, because this is a compressed cross-sectional view. In the southern part of the state, we've got the Columbia flood basalts. In the northern part of this state, we've got the Okanagan region that we're in. And then here's our North American. Here's the, right about where we go into Washington and Idaho, we get beneath the historic North American craton. Mm-hmm. Right? So everything here is the result. The underneath portions is the result of those accretionary events, those huge collisions with our continent. Right? Now, here's another thing that's really cool about this, is because in this area, what do we see here? Those are huge. This is a cartoon, right? But these are huge lobes of intrusive igneous rock that has eventually been exposed that we're looking at today, right? So when you look at this map, hopefully the colors make more sense, right? Because we can see that we've got this large coastal range. What do you think the exposed rock in this region consists a lot of? It's all that stuff that got scraped off the plate and jammed into the air. Right? Here, we're in the middle region of our state, right? This is all of our volcanic terrains. We've got this huge area right here that's all the Columbia Basin. And then here's where we are up here. Here's Lake Chelan. And I would imagine that we are about right there. Oh, that's the Columbia. I'm sorry. Hang on. Do we see it? Do we see it? Right there. Sorry.
Yeah.
There we go. All right. All right. So here's minerals. So what are minerals? Minerals are essentially the... I apologize. I missed my spot on the map. So minerals, what are minerals? Minerals are, this is the definition that we have almost everybody try to memorize. Minerals are naturally occurring inorganic homogeneous solids formed by geologic processes with ordered internal arrangement of atoms and a definable chemical composition. Oh. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Yeah. What does it mean? What does it mean? Let's think about each of these words. So naturally occurring. Super important.
It's part of the normal process of life.
Anybody else?
Not by people.
It just happens.
Not made in a lab.
It just happens, right?
Yeah.
All right. Generally inorganic.
Not alive.
No, not alive.
Yeah. Geologic processes. Geology. Rocks. Ordered internal arrangement of atoms. Yeah, they have a structure that's related to what they are, right? What about definable chemical composition? Does that mean they've got to have an exact composition?
Maybe not.
They can exist over a range of compositions, right? And if I move this forward, hang on, I don't know why it's not working. I think I've turned it off. Oh, here we go. All right. So the way minerals form are basically atoms or ions come together in a specific internal structure. And I want to tell you the story of the two saddest ions in the world, right? All right, so let's see. We've got a nucleus and we've got a first valence shell. Does that look familiar to everybody?
Yeah.
All right, so here we've got, what do we got? What is that?
Hydrogen.
If I put another one on here, what do we got? Helium. Oh boy, we're about to get really sad. What is this poor fella?
Lithium.
Lithium is one of the saddest ions ever. Why is lithium so sad?
It wants to get rid of one.
It wants a body.
It doesn't feel like itself, right? Everywhere it goes, he thinks to himself, I have this experience when I sit in an airline seat, right? I should be smaller than this. Every time he turns around, this extra thing is like I'm wearing a suit that's five times too big. And then what is this fella right here? So we've got boom, boom, and we've got one, two. Right? Nice little F right here. Yeah, of fluorine. What is he thinking? It's like, I feel so incomplete. Right? He spends his entire existence looking at neon, going, oh, you look so perfect. If I only had one more, I would be complete. Right? These two have the opportunity to make a deal, right? One has something that the other needs, right? And so long as we give them an opportunity to communicate, they'll make that happen on their own. That's what they want, right? And all of geologic chemistry is fundamentally related to this desire. The sad ions that want to be happier, right? And if we can think about the variety of ways that nature creates ion soups, right? Where ions have the ability to communicate, the ability to move around, the ability to make themselves feel fulfilled and happy, right? They'll get there, right? And so long as we give them time and space, they'll create minerals. I think I've lost my... Well, here we go. They'll create minerals. It happens in three different ways. The first way is in a melt, right? When we have a magma, those ions are free. That means that the calciums and the irons, and the magnesiums, and the aluminums all have an opportunity to find their happy place, right? If we give them time. It happens in dissolved water. Water is an ion magnet, right? If you've ever, has anybody here ever dealt with distilled water? Mm-hmm. Oh, nothing will eat up everything better than distilled water. It's an ion magnet, right? But ions that are dissolved in water have the ability to communicate with each other. They have the ability to move around. And then we've got a third way. And this is a special way that we're going to spend most of the second half of this presentation talking about. It's ions that are moving in the solid state. Right? Now, this is harder. It takes really special conditions. And the one big thing that it takes more than anything else? Well, it definitely needs pressure. But time. Right? An ion moving in the solid state, that's not going to happen fast, right? Okay, so those are minerals. These are rocks, right? And the difference between a rock and a mineral is simply that a rock is an aggregate of minerals, right? All rocks are composed of minerals of some sort. And they can be, so in this case, this is granite. And we've got a mineral called orthoclase feldspar. We've got a mineral called quartz. We've got a mineral called biotite. And we've got a mineral called plagioclase feldspar. Just one example. This is granite. Right?
What's basalt and why is there so much basalt in coming down not only through Washington, but well down into Central Oregon?
That takes about 5 slides, and it starts in about 2 minutes.
Hold on.
But first, we're going to talk about 3 rock groups. Are these the rock groups we're talking about?
Yeah.
What are the rock groups that we're talking about?
Igneous.
Igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary. All right, so this is the rock cycle, and we talked about this yesterday just very briefly, and I think that the very important point to talk about, the point that I would like to make, is that all of the rock types are igneous, right, are igneous, are sedimentary, and are metamorphic, are fundamentally related, right? And the nice orderly pattern that you see here around the outside of this circle is not necessarily how it has to be, right? We have the ability to melt sedimentary rock. We can go from sediment to magma, right? We have the ability to metamorphose igneous rock directly, right? So this structure is very useful, but it's not always how it happens, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, the sedimentary rocks that we're looking at are the result of multiple processes of sedimentation and weathering, right? So here's our 3 rock groups. We've got our sedimentary, we've got our igneous, and we've got our metamorphic. And what we're going to first talk about is how we make igneous rocks. And essentially, these form when previously existing rocks melt and solidify within the upper crust, right? I think of this as a relatively easy concept, but they get pretty complex when you think about the different types of igneous rocks we can have. So here's a catalyst question for you. I want you to think about this and then talk to your neighbor and compare notes. Did you observe visible mineral grains in the rock that you looked at? If not, please find a rock that lets you see visible grains.
They were over, yeah, up there.
Are we talking about grains like specks or grains?
Well, just is your rock composed of individual grains? And they don't have to be igneous grains. They're just individual grains.
All right.
Because a lot of these rocks are metamorphic. Oh, we should have lights. There we go. Look at that. All right, so now we're going to ask another question. Here, now we all have the same rocks to look at. Let's look at these and tell me what you see. Do you see individual grains in this rock?
Yes.
What about this one?
No.
Much harder, right?
Right.
What about this one?
Yes.
What about that one?
No.
No. What about these two?
Yes. Probably no.
Kind of maybe? All right.
Did you go get your own?
So here's the deal.
Oh, that's sweet.
These three rocks are formed from the same magma. Identical magma. Chemical composition is the same. That's granite. We call that rhyolite. This is tuft, right? This is gabbro. That's basalt. That's scoria. Chemically the same. What's the difference? Oh, hang on. I got a couple different answers.
Cooling rate,
right? That cooled very slowly. That ion soup had an opportunity to communicate, right? Those minerals that you see here, the plagioclase, the feldspar, the quartz, all had the ability in that ion soup to find their happy place, right? If we give them less time, what happens? Those minerals found their happy places, but they weren't able to find other happy couples to match up with, right? So you got really small grains here, really big grains there. These didn't have any time at all, right? We essentially, these were quenched instantly, right?
Are you talking geological time, or are you talking like that?
That's a fabulous question. These were quenched like that.
Okay.
These cooled over 1,000 years.
Yeah.
These could have cooled over 50,000 years. These could have cooled over 100 years.
Yeah.
Right. These cooled near the surface. These cooled at the surface. These cool deep in the ground, right? Okay. Importance of time. Essentially is this. When we form rocks deep in the earth, they cool extremely slowly. Rocks are highly insulatory. They do not transfer heat well, right? It's why we use them as potholders. It's why we use them as fireplaces, right? Essentially, rocks take a long time to move any type of heat energy. On the other hand, if we can take that lava and dump it out onto the seafloor, water will quench it real fast, right? Okay. All right, thought experiment. Come up with some ideas. What factors do you think control the rate at which a magma body cools?
What if the lava flows into the ocean?
Well, that is definitely one. But what I want you to do is to talk to each other and come up with a list of what you think are the important factors. Okay, let's ask some questions. If I've got a magma body where the volume is big, does it cool faster or slower than if the volume was small?
Slower.
Yeah. More volume, longer cool time, right? Okay. What about, so that's one thing. What about shape? If this was the same volume as this and that, they're all the same, which one cools the slowest?
V.
They're all these. But the big round one, right?
Are they all the same material?
Same material. Yeah. They're all the same material. Yeah. Holding material constant. Right? We all agree that this one would cool the slowest? All right. What if I take the rock around it and make it almost as hot? Or if I make the rock very cool? All right, so we got three key things that control that rate of cooling, right? We got the volume of the body, we got the shape of the body, and we got the differential between what it's next to, right? So when we have a sufficiently large body, and when we have all of those other criteria met, we have the ability to cool rocks very slowly, and we get nice big grains. Right? Now, the fancy word for this is phaneritic, right? The easy way to say it is just big grained, coarse grained. Okay? Similarly, if we have rocks that cool very quickly because either they were small in volume, or they were exposed to something that was very cold, or they were deposited in either a sill, which is a horizontal body, or a dike, which is a vertical body, we get very, very small grains. Those ions don't have much time to talk. Right? So, let's take our thought experiment one step further. What happens when we give a melt zero time to cool? What happens to the minerals then?
No ion transfer.
Small grains?
Do we get any grains at all?
Probably not.
Yeah, we get glass, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think.
The glass, yeah.
What happens if we take a melt, give a melt time to cool slowly, and then we speed it up? I heard somebody use a fancy word. So I got a question. When it was cooling slowly, would we have grown big grains? When we quenched the rest of it quickly, what would happen to the what we would call the ground mass?
Maybe crystallization.
All right. Well, let's look at these and take a thought. Do a quick test. Which one is cool? Slow cooling.
A.
We all agree on that. Okay. Which one would we say is fast cooling?
C.
Yeah, I'm going to go with C. Because there's a very fast cooling available. Right? Okay, which one is very fast cooling?
B.
Is there more than one, maybe?
D.
Yeah, D. And now, what's this one doing?
Cooling slower than fast.
Yeah, we got these nice big crystals, and then the rest of it's slow. Right? Okay. Okay, so we talked about the importance of time. Here's the importance of silica, right? And we've got two end members. These are what are called felsic lavas, right? And these have a lot of silica. These are mafic lavas, and they have much less silica, right? Our felsic lavas are the things that we get most of our granites from, right? Or rhyolites, the pink stuff. Our mafic end member are our gabbros and our basalts, right?
Are those the ones you see more likely in like Hawaii?
Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh, yep. In fact, if we looked at a graph that kind of took us through this is the mineral olivine, and it's at one end of the spectrum, right? This is what we call ultramafic. This is the stuff that our mantle is made out of. And as we move this way, we go through our gabbros and basalts, which have, instead of a lot of olivine, now have a mineral called pyroxene that's very, very dark. And can everybody see the white stuff in here? Mm-hmm. That's that calcium-rich plagioclase right up there, right? So it looks really dark, but there's light minerals there that are just a little bit harder to see. And then we go, does this look familiar to anybody? Anybody seen this lying around? Every third rock out there. This is what's called a diorite, right? And instead of having a lot of pyroxene, it has much less pyroxene. But it has another dark mineral called amphibole, and it has a little bit of what we call biotite, which is kind of a platy mineral that's pretty cool. But then we got a lot more of this stuff, right? And then these are rocks that we don't see around here very much. Those are granites. And we've got very, very little dark stuff, a whole lot of light stuff, and a bunch of pink stuff that are hard to see. So when we talk about this mafic end member, we're talking about stuff that's right in here. And this graph gives us kind of an idea of the amount of light stuff versus dark stuff, right? Where the ultramafic end of this graph is over here. Here's our mafic end, and we see that well represented in this gabbro, right? So what's the tectonic setting that we find gabbro or basalt? I believe you were asking this question just a moment ago, right?
Yeah, is it volcanic in origin?
Yeah, well, this is definitely volcanic in origin, and we see this is what Hawaii is made out of, and this is also what a lot of eastern Washington is made out of, right? Because we have shield volcanoes that are essentially a direct conduit of this. So this is oceanic crust. This is our magma chamber. And we're going to basically dump this material out onto the ground at a very, very, very high temperature. And because it's at a very, very high temperature, it rolls in all directions and makes a relatively flat lying deposit. Yeah.
Why is there so much? We were recently down to east of Salem, Oregon, and they were saying that basalt came from the same place. It just flowed all over the place.
Yep. So real quickly, I'm going to show you guys pillow basalts. This is what we see on the seafloor, right? So this is at a mid-ocean ridge. We talked a little bit about that yesterday, and I think we should go ahead and get to, this is what you're asking about, right? So this is the Columbia Plateau. These are the Columbia River basalts, right? And I think they date between 14 and 17 million years ago, approximately. Is that about right? This emplacement of basalt is a series of massive eruptions, and I mean massive eruptions, that happened, I think it happened over 300 times during that period, 14 to 17 million years ago. And each of these eruptions would have lasted about a week, and the amount of basalt that they released was absolutely stunning. Right? You can see here how deep we've cut into this basalt. Let's get another look at it. Here's these stacks of basalt, and every single one of these is an individual flow that went for miles in all directions. Right? How big do you think it was?
Big.
So I got a question. Is one of these, is this bigger or smaller than St. Helens?
Bigger.
Bigger.
Many times bigger.
What about, does anybody know about Krakatoa?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Krakatoa is awesome. Yeah. One of my better seagoing experiences is seeing Krakatoa as it came over the horizon at dawn.
Don't tell me this is worth that.
What?
Don't tell me this is bigger.
Oh, I'm going to tell you.
Whoa. Whoa. Wow.
Itsy bitsy Krakatoa. Felt very small next to Columbia River basalts. All right, so here's St. Helens. Right there. There's Krakatoa. Krakatoa is the type of volcano that they were able to, so this happens in the Strait of Java, right? Mm-hmm. They can hear it audibly in Australia, mm-hmm. change the Earth's climate for a decade. Wow. big explosion. There's the Columbia River salts. Right? All right. So this is Bolin's reaction series. And we've kind of talked about this portion of it so far. We've talked about the formation of mafic rocks. Talked a little bit about ultramafic rocks. But essentially what we're doing is we're looking at these individual minerals, right? Where those minerals became happy. And there's a temperature relationship here, right? If I have an average melt, right? If I just have a big pot of magma. Can we say magma together? I really like saying magma. Yeah. Right, if I got a big pot of magma, right? And it's very, very hot. That hot. Right? The only thing that I can form when we're that hot is this mineral. Right? And as I continue to cool, if I leave this mineral suspended in the mix, some of it's going to go away. Or I can remove this from the mix by letting those minerals settle out. But as I get cooler, I'm able to form a different set of minerals. As I get down into this temperature region, I stop forming olivine. Olivine becomes less happy. I told you we were going to do that mineral feely thing, right? And suddenly a mineral called pyroxene becomes very happy. Very happy. Amphibole gets happier as pyroxene gets less happy. Right? They just can't get along. Right? And then we get down into the intermediate rocks where pyroxene suddenly becomes very unhappy, but amphibole continues to be happy. Right? And biotite becomes happy. And all the while, our good friend Plage has been just delighted. Okay? This is about those ions and about finding their happy places. And this also tells you something about the opposite process, the weathering process, right? Do you guys see a lot of sand that has olivine in it? Only a couple places in the world, right? When you go to the beach, what's in the sand for the most part? All that stuff, right? And it's because at Earth surface pressure and temperature, this is the happiest of all, right? All of this stuff, when you take it away from its happy temperature, its temperature of formation, suddenly it's less stable in the environment, right? So this is why these things weather away very quickly, and these things stick around for a really long period of time.
There's a place on the Big Island called Green Sand Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Is it different than what makes it green, for one thing?
Well, it's because it's right next to a source of olivine, right? So Kilauea erupting is bringing up olivine crystals, and they're there long enough for us to see them here. But for most of the rest of geologic structures, that's a very hard beach to find, right? Okay, so here's our intermediate rocks. We've kind of come into this area where we've got a lot of white stuff, a little bit of dark stuff, right? I had thought when I wrote this that we'd have a whole bunch of diorite, but I don't think we really do, right? But we've seen this all around the neighborhood. When you get a chance, pick one up, take a look at it, right? And what you're going to see is that now we have a lot of dark minerals, amphiboles, biotites, and then we've got some white minerals, all of that plage, right? And in this tectonic setting, what's important to recognize is that we're getting rocks that are right here in the middle between this and that. How do we do that? It goes back to that subduction zone, right?
Lava mixture.
I'm bringing this stuff in my subducting plate, and I'm going underneath all of those accreted terrains, right? And so when I erupt, or when I solidify, or when I cool, I get something that is no longer my vanilla ice cream. It is no longer my hot fudge. It is something in the middle, right?
Rocky Road.
Rocky Road. Yeah. Right? Okay. Okay. So here's flux melting in the subduction zone. And essentially, this image is supposed to show you essentially that exact process occurring, right? Now, the other thing that occurs when we take all of this goo down deep is that we bring a lot of volatiles into the system, right? There's a lot of water vapor, there's a lot of carbon dioxide, and that's combined with the general high viscosity of the resulting lavas, that's what makes these so explosive. So magmas often form form complex compositions. We basically see lots of evidence of this in our neck of the woods. We've got places where we've had partially molten country rock interacting with basaltic magma, creating very, very complex overall granitic rock compositions. Right? Okay. So there's our cross-sectional view again. That is a way to explain or understand why we see so much intermediate composition rocks in our region. Does that make sense to everybody? How you guys feeling so far?
Good.
Yep.
So
yes, ma'am.
Mr. Holden shows up here.
Mr. Holden.
Mr. Holden, the fine design.
Yep.
What made him know that there was probably copper up here?
Well, so. Where we see a lot of mining deposits are also places where we see a lot of hydrothermal activity, right? So essentially, we have, let's continue down here. Let's see what this next one is. All right, so here's our rock cycle, right? This is a good question, and it's not one that is part of this presentation, but I think it's worth addressing right now. The reason we have mines where we have mines, right? Or the reasons where we have commercially viable resources are typically resources that as a composition of our total Earth volume are relatively small percentages, right? So if you think about our Earth's volume, a typical first geology class is thinking about how much of Earth is iron, right? How much of our Earth is oxygen, right? How much of our Earth is aluminum and copper? These commercially viable materials are a very, very small percentage of the total volume of our Earth. So in order to make a mine work, you have to have a process that concentrates them, right? You have to have something that is basically filtering through a large volume of bulk Earth stuff and leaving that stuff in one place, right? And most commonly, that's some sort of hydrothermal fluid, right? And it's in areas where we see a lot of metamorphic rock, which is kind of our next big topic, because we've talked about the igneous rock. We're not going to talk a lot about sedimentary rock, but we are going to talk about the metamorphic rocks, right? And so a lot of the processes that metamorphose rocks also act as areas where we can concentrate things. All right. So, question, why do we bake our pottery? Changes it, right? If you just went in and made a clay cup and went to get your coffee in it, what would your result be?
Not good.
So what's happening when we bake that cup?
Crystallizes.
Yeah. It metamorphoses, right? We take some portion of that clay mineral, right, and we get it hot enough that the individual grains are no longer separate, right? We've essentially made it to where if you broke the cup, it wouldn't necessarily pull apart in between those grains. You'd actually be breaking a grain at a microscopic level, right? And metamorphism is essentially the process where we take a previously existing rock and through some process of pressure and temperature make it to where it changes, right? Where the grain boundaries are no longer where it would break, right? And we do that in the solid state. So when we bake that piece of pottery, we don't melt it, right? Same is true in a metamorphic rock. So metamorphic rocks are essentially when the original rock, so here's a nice granodiorite, right? It has a random orientation of mineral grains pointed every which way, distributed fairly evenly through the entire structure. And we've, through some process of squeezing it and pressurizing it, we've allowed those ions to find a different happy place, right? Those ions were happy, but then we started to squeeze them. We started to heat them, and they became mobile again, right? And you can see here that this granodiorite has essentially allowed these different minerals to segregate. The light stuff wants to be with the light stuff. The dark stuff wants to be with the dark stuff. The platy stuff wants to be aligned, right? So the question is, how do we do that? Well, mechanism number one, well, these are the, basically the combination of mechanisms. We got pressure, we've got heat, right? That essentially reorients the entire thing. So let's look at the different sessions. So our agents of metamorphism, number one is heat, right? That kinetic energy that's associated with making something's temperature higher allows those ions to get back out and move around. Lithostatic pressure, we squeeze it the same in all directions. Once again, we release those ions, they move around. We have directed pressure, right? If anybody can take their hands and try to move it across something that's not quite easy to move across, we can create the sense of shear that's associated with frictional forces, right? And then hydrothermal fluids is the magic for almost anything, right? Remember, water is an ion magnet, right? Yeah, what was that? I thought I saw a hand. All right, so by doing this, we can take shale, turn it into slate. We can take a slate and turn it into a phyllite. Can everybody see the difference between this phyllite and that slate? Right? This kind of a shiny look, almost like you took some pottery out of the oven, right? Mm-hmm. Right? This is what's called a phyllitic sheen. If we continue to bury that, squeeze it and heat it, we get a schist, and then eventually we get nice. Right? And we see these evidences of these all over the place here. Right? So mechanism number one is heat. This is an example of a cooked rock called Hornsfeld's. It's essentially a rock that was right next to a magma body. Mechanism number two is pressure, essentially squeezing from all directions. What's that? This is called foliation. And there are some amazing examples of this in the village. Not only in the village, but in outcrop. Has anybody been to the, what is it, Tenema Falls?
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody been there yet?
Yep.
Did anybody see a really beautiful rock formation that was all twisted and looked kind of like that?
Tortured rock.
Yeah, tortured rock. All right, so what's happening here? We were squeezing it, right? Can anybody, what were the original bedding planes? If this was sedimentary rock originally, what were the bedding planes?
What?
Can you see them?
Yeah.
Boom, 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 and boom. Right? So as we were depositing sediment, we're just stacking vertically. Now, what has happened is that we have squeezed this so hard and for so long that the platy minerals the little flat, sparkly minerals that you guys have probably noticed around have actually all turned on end and are oriented perpendicular to the direction of that pressure. So you can tell yourself a story when you look at that rock, right? You can see where the direction of pressure was from. Let's take a look. Here's a better example, I think, of what we see in outcrop, right? Where essentially we can see bedding planes, boom, 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 and boom, right? But we can also see the direction of stress, which is perpendicular to these lines right here. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions about that?
So what put the side pressure on the perpendicular pressure?
A collision with a mountain chain. Right? Because we've had, what have we been having happen here? We've had these accreted terrains, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got a continent that's moving in this direction. We've got these island arcs that are moving in this direction, right? And we're going to squeeze. We also have had volcanoes that have grown up. Put a volcano into the system, everything else gets squeezed. Right? But the bottom line is, we have an opportunity to see foliation. And you can see these in this. Does this look like rocks that we've seen around the village? Mm-hmm. Right? And essentially what you can see here is that we've got these little muscovite flakes. These very, very, very small platy minerals, the shiny ones, the sparkly ones, the ones that my daughter just loves, right? They have all been aligned parallel. And if we do this at a higher pressure and temperature, we get a schist. And we've seen a few of these around the village as well, right? Here's a great image, right? Of tortured rock. All right. Mechanism 3, hydrothermal fluids, right? And this is a method for concentrating earth minerals or rare earth minerals, right? Through the use of these through the use of hot water, basically escaping from a cooling magma chamber. It's chemically active, and those dissolved ions eventually get deposited when the water evaporates.
And that works with cooler water, but more slowly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So here's parent rock, shale, metamorphic rock, slate. Parent rock, granodiorite, metamorphosed rock, gneiss. And here's kind of an idea of what types of environments we expect these to happen in, right? Our sedimentary environments, anything under 200 degrees. Our igneous environment, anywhere between 700 degrees and 1200 degrees. Everything in the middle is metamorphism, right? This is the surface earth. This is the deep earth. That's what's in between. Yay? All right, last question. Here are high-grade textural changes. We can turn a fine-grained limestone into a coarse-grained marble. We can take a coarse-grained granite and become something very fine-grained, what we call a myelinite, right? And where we expect to see these types of changes, right? Shale is a protolith, low-grade is a slate, slightly higher-grade is a phyllite, medium-high-grade is a schist, and very high-grade is a gneiss.
What's grade mean?
Just the amount that it's been metamorphosed. Right? Here's a cross section that kind of shows this process. Here's our volcano. Here's a magma chamber. We expect contact metamorphism right next to our hot stuff. And as we get further away, the different types of metamorphism change. Right? The higher the heat, the higher the grade. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think then that this is our last thing, right? Where is metamorphic intensity, the metamorphic intensity the most intense, and why? Is it where we have a contact metamorphism? Is it where we've buried something? Is it in a fault? Or is it underneath the mountain? What do you think? Why? Yeah, because we got them both, right? We've got all the pressure and we've got all the heat. All right. That's all we're doing today. Thank you very much. I think we've got... Yeah, we should take the rocks back. We've got about 10 minutes left before we're supposed to be done, so if anybody's got any questions or wants to talk about anything, I'm happy to do that.